from Cornell after 15 years in order to take a position designing electrical measuring instruments for Mather Electrical Company in Manchester, Connecticut. Soon to be president of the AIEE himself, Anthony was pleased with his tests. Along with Martin, he helped coax Tesla into presenting his motor before the newly formed Electrical Society. Martin had great difficulty persuading Tesla to give any paper at all. Martin said that Tesla stood very much alone, as the majority of the electricians were entirely unfamiliar with the motor's value. In haste, Tesla wrote out his lecture the night before in pencil. It had not been easy for him to construct an efficient machine, but having finally succeeded and having passed all of Professor Anthony's stringent tests for efficiency, nothing now stood in the way of its commercial development, except that they had to be constructed with a view to operating on the circuits then existing, which in this country were all of high frequency. On May 15, 1888, Tesla appeared before the AIEE to read his landmark paper, A New Alternating Current Motor. He had already filed for 14 of the 40 fundamental patents on the AC system, but he was still reluctant to fully announce his work. Realizing that the invention was worth at a minimum hundreds of thousands of dollars, Tesla and company sought investors through the advice of their new patent attorneys, Parker W. Page, Leonard E. Curtis, and General Samuel Duncan, the last a leader of the firm and respected member of the New York Bar Association. By the time of the lecture, Tesla, Peck, and Brown had already been negotiating with prospective buyers, such as Mr. Butterworth, a gas manufacturer from San Francisco, and through General Duncan, George Westinghouse of Pittsburgh. But nothing as yet was settled. Westinghouse was already utilizing an alternating current system developed by the erratic French inventor Lucien Goulard and the sporty entrepreneur John Dixon Gibbs of England. In 1885, his manager of the electrical division, Guido Pantaleone, had returned to Turin, Italy, to attend the funeral of his father. By coincidence, through his engineering professor Galileo Ferraris, whom Westinghouse himself had met while visiting Italy in 1882, Pantaleone was introduced to Lucien Goulard, who had installed his AC apparatus between Tivoli and Rome. Goulard and Gibbs had already made headlines 2 years earlier when they first exhibited their invention at the Royal Aquarium in London. But in Turin, the system won a gold medal and a prize of £400 awarded by the Italian government. Westinghouse purchased the American patent rights in late November after receiving a cable request from Pantaleone. The Goulard-Gibbs system, although improved by the Hungarian ZBD system, still had serious problems. For Westinghouse, this was further complicated by the fact that Edison owned the option on the ZBD, and it was probably to block competitors that Edison purchased the system to begin with. In the same year, in America, after creating the Westinghouse Electric Company, Westinghouse placed William Stanley in charge of the Goulard-Gibbs modifications. Simultaneously, he brought to America Reginald Belfield, the engineer who had helped install the Goulard-Gibbs system at the Inventions Exhibition in London 2 years earlier. Stanley, a frail, thin-faced, temperamental little man with piercing eyes, aquiline nose, wispy moustache, and alfalfa hairdo, was a native of Brooklyn who had worked for Hiram Maxim, inventor of the machine gun. Although it was Westinghouse's idea to place Stanley in charge of the Goulard-Gibbs apparatus, Stanley would later maintain that Westinghouse never fully understood the system until he got it in working order. This appears unlikely, for it was a private joke among the upper echelon of the Westinghouse company that Stanley had a penchant for claiming new discoveries when they became such to him. In any case, Westinghouse hedged his bets by establishing numerous DC central stations as well, while research on AC was in progress. Nervous and agile Stanley was a hypersensitive individual who never really got along with Westinghouse. Due to ill health and on the advice of the general manager, Colonel Henry Bilsby, who proposed that success might be more forthcoming if Stanley separated himself from the pressures of the company, the inventor returned to his childhood summer retreat in the Berkshires in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, to work on the Goulard-Gibbs system in private, taking Reginald Belfield with him. Stanley converted the Goulard-Gibbs arrangement to parallel circuitry and independent control of separate fixtures, and at the same time created a transformer which stepped up the AC from 500 volts to 3,000 when delivered along a transmission line and stepped them back down to original levels when entering the households. This invention, although very similar to the ZBD configuration, was nevertheless patentable. It enabled AC to be sent three-quarters of a mile, or approximately one-quarter of a mile farther than the lower voltages of the prevailing DC systems. On April 6, 1886, George Westinghouse, along with Colonel Henry Bilsby, travelled up to New Hampshire to witness the landmark apparatus for themselves. Prior to coming to Westinghouse, Bilsby had been employed at the Edison Machine Works as a mechanical engineer and was one of the designers of the Pearl Street Station. "From that time on," Bilsby said, "we progressed with amazing speed." By the time of Tesla's lecture, Westinghouse noted that his company had sold more central stations on the alternating current system than of all the other electric companies in the country put together on the direct current system. But few engineers understood the principles involved. In fierce competition with Westinghouse and a third player, Elihu Thompson of Thompson Houston Electric Company, Thomas Edison had received a report on his own alternating current ZBD system. His engineers in Berlin indicated that the use of such high voltages was exceedingly dangerous. Thompson, who himself had lectured at the AIEE a year before on the topic of AC, supported Edison's contention that AC was too risky. Thus, at the time Tesla spoke, the battle of the currents had already begun, but the makeup of the contenders was complex. In 1886, fully 2 years before Tesla's high-voltage AC system became manifest, Edison had written to his manager, "Just as certain as death, Westinghouse will kill a customer within 6 months after he puts in a system of any size. He's got a new thing, and it will require a great deal of experimenting to get it working practically. It will never be free from danger." Tesla's lecture began with a brief description of the existing diversity of opinion regarding the relative merits of the alternate and continuous current systems. "Great importance," Tesla continued, "is attached to the question whether alternate currents can be successfully utilized in the operation of motors." He followed this preamble with a lucid description of the problem of the prevailing technology and his elegant solution explained in words, diagrams, and simple mathematical calculations. The lecture was so thorough that many engineers, after studying the work, felt that they had known it all along. "I have the pleasure of bringing to your notice a novel system of electrical distribution and transmission of power by means of alternate currents, which I am confident will at once establish the superior adaptability, and will show that many results heretofore unattainable can be reached by their use. In our dynamo machines, it is well known we generate alternate currents which we direct by means of a commutator, a complicated device and the source of most of the troubles experienced. Now, the currents so directed cannot be utilized in the motor, but they must be reconverted into their original state. In reality, therefore, all machines are alternate current machines, the current appearing continuous only in the external circuit during their transit from generator to motor." Since Tesla's lecture was dealing with fundamentals, it was easily understood, even though his invention was so revolutionary. By demonstration in Tesla's laboratory after the lecture, the inventor showed that his synchronous motors could almost instantaneously be reversed. He also described, in precise mathematical calculations, how to determine the number of poles and speed of each motor, how to construct single-phase, two-phase, and three-phase motors, and how his system could be interlinked with DC apparatus. The lecture made use of entirely new principles. Now electricity could be transported hundreds of miles from a single distribution point, and not just for lighting streets or dwellings, but for running appliances in households and industrial machinery in factories. At the end of the talk, T.C. Martin called upon Professor William Antony to present his independent tests of the Tesla motors. He had designed dynamos himself, which he had displayed a decade earlier at the Philadelphia Exposition of 1876. Tugging nervously at his scraggly beard, Antony confirmed that the Tesla motors he had taken back to Cornell had had an efficiency comparable to the best DC apparatus. A little over 60%, he said, for the larger models. Moreover, the reversal of direction that the machines could achieve took place so quickly that it was almost impossible to tell when the change took place. Boiling inside at having been anticipated by a newcomer, the persnickety professor Elihu Thompson stepped forward. Wanting to re-establish that his work in AC predated Tesla's, Thompson pointed out how their inventions differed. "I have been very much interested in the description given by Mr. Tesla of his new and admirable little motor," he managed with a pert smile. "I have, as probably you may be aware, worked in somewhat similar directions and towards the attainment of similar ends. The trials which I have made have been by the use of a single alternating current circuit, not a double alternating circuit, a single circuit supplying a motor constructed to utilize the alternation and produce rotation." Unbeknown to Thompson, his words at that moment would come back to haunt him, because he had identified precisely the difference between the two creations. Whereas Thompson's single AC circuit had to still make use of a commutator, and thus was highly inefficient, Tesla's system utilized two or more circuits out of phase with each other and constructed in such a way as to make the commutator obsolete. Tesla, of course, recognized the importance of Thompson's words and reiterated the point to establish clearly that his invention just presented was not analogous to Thompson's prior work. "Gentlemen," Tesla began, "I wish to say that the testimony of such a man as Professor Thompson flatters me very much." Pausing with a smile and a bow of recognition, Tesla timed his coup de grace with understated finesse. "I had a motor identically the same as that of Professor Thompson, but I was anticipated by him. That peculiar motor represents the disadvantage that a pair of brushes, i.e. a commutator, must be employed." In this brief riposte, Tesla claimed the high ground and created an enemy who would fight him on this and other priority issues, e.g. the Tesla coil, for the rest of their lives. Now Westinghouse had to move fast. He realized the value of the Tesla patent applications, having had nearly a month to look them over, along with the report from Professor Anthony. A week after the lecture, on May the 21st, he sent Colonel Henry Bilsby to Tesla's laboratory. Bilsby met with fellow engineer Alfred Brown on Cortlandt Street, where he was introduced to Charles Peck, the lawyer and major financial backer of the Tesla Electric Company. Together with a fourth man, Mr. Humbard, they went over to Liberty Street to meet the inventor and see the machines in operation.
"Mr. Tesla struck me as being a straightforward, enthusiastic sort of a party," Bilsby wrote to Westinghouse, "but his description was not of a nature which I was enabled entirely to comprehend. However, I saw several points which I think are of interest. In the first place, as near as I can get at it, the underlying principle of this motor is the principle which Mr. Schallenberger is at work on at the present moment. The motors, as far as I could judge, are a success. They start from rest, and the reversion of the direction of rotation is suddenly accomplished without any short-circuiting. In order to avoid giving the impression that the matter was one which excited my curiosity, I made my visit short." Back at Cortlandt Street, Brown and Peck informed Bilsby that he had to make a decision by 10 o'clock Friday of this week, as the company was also negotiating with a Mr. Butterworth from San Francisco. They claimed that Professor Anthony had joined this California syndicate and was backing up Butterworth's offer of $250,000 in short-term notes and a royalty of $2.50 per watt of horsepower.
"I told them the terms were monstrous," Bilsby said, "but they replied that they could not possibly hold the matter over longer than the date mentioned. I told them I thought there was no possibility of our considering the matter seriously, but that I would let them know before Friday."
Bilsby suggested that Westinghouse come to New York himself, or send Schallenberger and another representative. But Westinghouse, who was familiar with the San Francisco syndicate, told Bilsby instead to stall them and try to secure more favorable terms. During the six-week interim, Westinghouse conferred with his specialists, Oliver Schallenberger and William Stanley, and his lawyer, E.M. Kerr. Just 3 weeks prior to Tesla's lecture, Schallenberger had discovered, by chance, that a loose spring spun in a shifting magnetic field. Directly, he said to his assistant Stillwell, who was also present, "There's a meter in that, and perhaps a motor." Within 2 weeks, he designed and built a most successful alternating current meter of the induction type, which became standard for the field. And, like Tesla's creation, his apparatus utilized a rotating magnetic field. Schallenberger, however, did not yet really understand the principles involved, nor had he had time to apply for a patent. Stanley, on the other hand, claimed that there was nothing new in Tesla's creation. He pointed out that in September 1883, he had put the idea down in a notebook that an induction coil could be excited by AC.
"I have built an AC system on basically the same principle, which allows electromotive force to be transmitted from power stations to homes for the purpose of illuminating them," he told Westinghouse.
But the fact of the matter was, Stanley's system still used a commutator. His ego had gotten in the way of his ability to reason objectively that his scheme was not analogous to Tesla's. Kerr reminded Westinghouse that unless he had a competing patent of sufficient strength, he would be powerless. Westinghouse was aware that Professor Ferraris of Turin, Italy, had published a paper on the rotating magnetic field 1 or 2 months prior to Tesla's lecture. Ferraris had also constructed disks that rotated in AC fields in university presentations as early as 1885. Tesla willingly admitted that Professor Ferraris not only came independently to the same theoretical results, but in a manner identical almost to the smallest detail. But Ferraris wrongly concluded that an apparatus founded upon this principle cannot be of any commercial importance as a motor. Nevertheless, Kerr realized the legal importance of Ferraris's work. He suggested to Westinghouse that they purchase the U.S. patent options, so Pantaleone was sent to Italy. He paid 5,000 francs, or about $1,000, for the rights. But time was running out. The Tesla people would not wait forever. Westinghouse wrote Kerr,
"I've been thinking over this motor question very considerably, and am of the opinion that if Tesla has a number of applications pending in the patent office, he will be able to cover broadly the apparatus that Schallenberger was experimenting with, and that Stanley thought he had invented. It is more than likely that he will be able to carry his date of invention back sufficient time to seriously interfere with Ferraris, and that our investment there will probably prove a bad one. If the Tesla patents are broad enough to control the alternating motor business, then the Westinghouse Electric Company cannot afford to have others own the patents."
Concerning the sticky point of royalties, which the Tesla syndicate placed at the audacious figure of $2.50 per watt, Westinghouse wrote,
"The price seems rather high, but if it is the only method for operating a motor by the alternating current, and if it is applicable to streetcar work, we can unquestionably easily get from the users of the apparatus whatever tax is put upon it by the inventors."
Thus, in no uncertain terms, Westinghouse writes here the portentous statement that royalty payments could be passed on to customers, a concept he would be forced later to conveniently overlook.
6. Induction at Pittsburgh, 1889.
"My first impression was that of a man with tremendous potential energy, of which only part had taken kinetic form. But even to a superficial observer, the latent force was manifest. A powerful frame, well proportioned, with every joint in working order, an eye as clear as crystal, a quick and springy step, he presented a rare example of health and strength. Like a lion in a forest, he breathed deep and with delight the smoky air of his factories."
Nikola Tesla on George Westinghouse. Although George Westinghouse had made his fortune with the invention of air brakes for trains, he was not just a railroad man. He was a descendant of the aristocratic Russian von Fistinghausen family. His father was also an inventor with 6 fundamental patents of farming machinery. With his brother Henry, who later became his partner, George early on was introduced to such devices as the battery and the sparking Leyden jar, a glass jar lined with foil and used for storing an electric charge. Having been a cavalry boy and later a Navy engineer during the Civil War, George Westinghouse had experience and vision. He knew that the future was in electricity. In late July 1888, Tesla took a train to Pittsburgh to meet with George Westinghouse and finalize the sale of his patents. It may have been the middle of summer, but oddly the inventor welcomed the intense heat. He looked forward to the meeting. Considerable in stature, with a walrus-sized moustache, Jester A. Arthur Sideburns, and a remarkable wife of equal proportion, who wore a bustle that jutted 3 feet to the rear, Westinghouse greeted the lanky inventor. A garrulous man, George Westinghouse subsumed those around him with his geniality and unbounded confidence. He took Tesla to his home and then on a tour of the plant. With nearly 400 employees, Westinghouse's electric company was mainly producing alternators, transformers, and accessories for equipping central stations for supplying incandescent lighting. Barrel-chested and physically expansive, Westinghouse counterbalanced in appearance the spindle-legged foreigner who walked as straight as an arrow with his head erect, but with a preoccupied air as if new combinations were crystallizing in his brain. Tesla said, "Though past 40 then, Westinghouse still had the enthusiasm of youth. Always smiling, affable and polite, he stood in marked contrast to the rough and ready men I met. Not one word which would have been objectionable, not a gesture which might have offended. One could imagine him as moving in the atmosphere of a court, so perfect was his bearing in manner and speech. And yet, no fiercer adversary than Westinghouse could have been found when he was aroused. An athlete in ordinary life, he was transformed into a giant when confronted with difficulties which seemed unsurmountable. He enjoyed the struggle and never lost confidence. When others would give up in despair, he triumphed." Known for his foresight and courage, Westinghouse had already quadrupled the sales of his electric company from $800,000 in 1887 to over $3 million in 1888, even though he was in the midst of expensive legal and propaganda battles with Edison. Extraordinary in his ability to generate enthusiasm in his workers and a decisive man of action, he immediately gained the respect of those he met, particularly Nikola Tesla. Westinghouse offered Tesla $5,000 in cash for a 60-day option, $10,000 at the end of the option if they elected to purchase the patents, 3 notes of $20,000 at 6-month intervals, $2.50 per watt in royalties, and 200 shares of stock in the Westinghouse Company. Minimum payment on the royalties was calculated at $5,000 for the first year, $10,000 for the second year, and $15,000 for each succeeding year thereafter during the life of the patents. Westinghouse also agreed to pay for any legal expenses in litigation on priority issues, but a clause for lowering payments was added should any suits be lost. Calculated out for 15 years, this figure, minus the stock, came to $75,000 in initial outlays and $180,000 in royalty payments, or approximately $255,000. Tesla owned 4/9 of his company, the balance shared by Peck and Brown, presumably 3/9 to the former partner and 2/9 to the latter. Concerning total amounts paid out by Westinghouse, Tesla also referred to European patents, especially in England and Germany. Thus, it's hard to determine exactly how much Tesla received for his 40 patents. Westinghouse was not only getting a simple induction motor, but also a variety of synchronous and load-dependent motors, as well as armatures, turbines, regulators, and dynamos. Tesla may have sold additional inventions later on in separate agreements. The value of his stockholding is also unclear. A decade later, Tesla wrote to another financier, John Jacob Astor, that Mr. Westinghouse agreed to pay for my rotating field patents about $500,000, and despite hard times, he has lived up to every cent of his obligation. Since Tesla was trying to raise money from Astor, he may have exaggerated the sum. 2 years earlier, Electrical Review noted that the Westinghouse annual report listed the purchase of the patents at $216,000, which is a figure that corresponds roughly to the Bilsby memorandum above, minus a few years' worth of royalty payments. If this was the case, then Tesla probably received for himself about half that figure, or $100,000, the entire amount paid in installments during the years 1888 to 97. During the negotiations, Tesla agreed to move to Pittsburgh to help develop his motor. It's quite possible that he received no salary for his stay there, for he had a peculiar principle ever since I devoted myself to scientific laboratory research, never to accept fees or compensations for professional services. Tesla had been paid for his patents and was receiving royalties or payments against royalties, so there was an income. Further evidence that no additional daily or weekly compensation was received is implied in a signed agreement by George Westinghouse dated July the 27th, 1889, substantiating that Tesla worked in Pittsburgh for 1 year and that during that time he was paid with 150 shares of capital stock. In return, Tesla promised to assign any patents to the Westinghouse company which were directly related to the development of his induction motor patents. Other compensation was received from Westinghouse, however, for other contributions. For instance, when Tesla discovered that Bessemer steel created a vastly superior transformer than ones made out of soft iron, Tesla was paid approximately $10,000 for the idea. Tesla gave up his garden apartment in New York and moved into one of several hotels in Pittsburgh, including the Metropolitan, the Duquesne, and the Anderson. Hotel living would become a lifestyle which he never departed from. His talk, just 2 months old, had already catapulted him to fame. About the middle of August 1888, in the Westinghouse testing room at Pittsburgh, Charles Scott, his assistant to be, remembered, "I'd just come with the company and was assistant to E. Spooner, who was running the Dynamo's testing room at night. He called me and said, 'There comes Tesla.' I had heard of Tesla," Scott continued, "having read Tesla's paper on the polyphase induction motor, which my former college professor had pronounced as a complete solution of the motor problem. And now I was to see Tesla himself." Fair-haired, with round rimless glasses, Scott had only learned that there was such a thing as alternating current the summer before, in 1887. "I had graduated from college 2 years earlier, and I wondered why I'd not heard of such things from my professors." His only introduction was an Electrical World article by William Stanley, which was a fascinating key to many mysteries. Now, a year later, he was to meet Nikola Tesla, the man who so elegantly solved all the puzzles proposed by Stanley. There he came, marching down the aisle with head and shoulders erect and with a twinkle in his eye. It was a great moment for me. Scott, who later became an engineering professor at Yale University, was Tesla's wireman in preparing and making tests. It was a splendid opportunity for a beginner, this coming in contact with a man of such eminence, rich in ideas, kindly and friendly in disposition. Tesla's fertile imagination often constructed air castles which seemed prodigious, but I doubt whether ever his extravagant expectations for the toy motor of those days measured up to actual realization, for the polyphase system which it inaugurated exceeded the wildest dreams of the early days. Scott was not only Tesla's assistant. As time went on, and against the opinion of many colleagues, he became a champion of Tesla's cause, a bearer of the truth, that is, that Tesla was the inventor of the induction motor. Another staunch supporter was Swiss immigrant Albert Schmidt, co-author of 2 AC patents with Tesla. Even though Westinghouse himself was also an ally, there was a bevy of other workers who tried seriously to strip Tesla of the crown. Major adversaries of the early period included Oliver Schallenberger, inventor of the AC meter, and his helpmate Louis B. Stillwell, inventor of the Stillwell booster, which operated somewhat like the Tesla coil. At a later period, the key antagonist was Andrew W. Robertson, Westinghouse's chief executive officer. Yet another opponent was William Stanley, the first American to have ever successfully instituted an AC system in the country. Stanley had split off from the Westinghouse Corporation circa 1892 to